Next case on the court's calendar is Kreisel versus Rossman. We're ready for arguments. Would counsel for appellant please introduce himself for the record?
Thank you and good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Grigsby. I'm arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Rossman, in this matter. So most of the matter is set forth before this court in our brief, but there's a couple of issues that I'd like to amplify that I think fills in some of the gaps between the initial briefing and the responsive brief by the respondent in this matter. So I wanted to focus the court's attention on a couple of arguments. One, dealing with self-employment, whether it was waived and whether he's self-employed. Then I want to talk about the substantial references to the deference to credibility that the respondent has argued in the brief. And then I want to talk finally about the disallowance of the mileage in this matter. So begin with self-employment. One of the arguments before this court is that appellant waived claiming that he was employed by the LLC by not raising it. But I don't think that it was really borne out by the facts in this case is that, first of all, it's not really an issue that one raises at the district court level. To the extent it requires some raising, there's evidence to support it, and that is that he submitted documents to suggest that there is an LLC that is an independent company, that the articles of its existence are on record with the Secretary of State, there have been tax files, and that the LLC makes specific recorded taxable payments to appellant in the normal course of its business. So to the extent that they say it's waived, there really isn't a situation where you get before the court and say, hey, I'm self-employed or I'm not self-employed. It's the documents were there, and it's the court's responsibility to make a determination of what child support is owed.
Right, but it's the responsibility of counsel to make specific arguments that it wants to before the district court, and if they want to make them on appeal, to make sure that they're preserved. And I think the specific argument here is whether or not he was the sole owner and subject to the statute. And it seems like the argument that's being made on appeal is a very different argument than was made in the district court.
Well, I don't think he didn't raise the issue expressly by standing before the court and saying, I'm self-employed. Or I'm not self-employed, I'm an employee of the corporation. But he certainly created an issue that was argued, that was submitted at the district court level with respect to how his income should be figured with respect to the K-1 payments from the LLC to him.
Before the district court, did your client ever say, look, Minnesota Statute 518A point, I think it is. 30, I believe it is, which the district court relied upon, said, that's not applicable, Your Honor. Is that ever done?
No, they make the argument. It's only after the court makes its initial findings that he's apprised of the fact that the court considered him not to be an individual employed by the LLC. This is, of course, one of the issues that you're appealing is that the court was wrong in its characterization of it as one versus the other. It's essentially the first time this becomes an issue is in the course of the district court's conclusions of law and findings of facts in this matter. So I don't think it was waived. Waiver is you know waiver has to be of substance. There's no prejudice to the other side. They had the same exact material and the argument on appeal. Doesn't require any new finding of fact, doesn't require this court to perform any deliberate exercise of jurisprudence that the district court wasn't able to provide at the time. So I don't think that their waiver argument is right. Now, the next one then is whether he's in fact self-employed. Now, there is a persuasive argument that he is self-employed. And it's the one that respondent makes here. And let me set it forth as charitably as I can with what it deserves. And that is that he and his brother basically run a construction business. They are the sole shareholders and employees of it. They simply take they deduct the expenses from the gross revenues and split the difference, and that's their income. So on the face of it, it looks exactly like what a simple partnership is. In practical terms, that's how it's worked. But the point is that the court essentially disregarded, gave absolutely no deference or weight to the fact that it's not a partnership. It's an LLC. It may operate as a partnership, but it's technically an LLC. The money is owed to the LLC. The LLC then distributes that income. Now, it's not unusual for an LLC to do this. In fact, that is why that form of company organization exists. It exists to provide the shielding and immunization from liability to small people, even companies composed of one person. And I think that, you know, the court's findings simply pretend that it's not an LLC and treat it exactly as a partnership. And the whole point is that creditors cannot touch the personal assets of the two people who are members of the LLC. And the truth is that that ought to apply precisely in the same way to the attachment of the assets made by the person who's claiming additional child support here. In other words, let me put it this way, is that I don't think it takes much, but there has to be some analysis of the court to simply disregard the existence of the LLC in toto before it can see that he is essentially identical to the LLC, and that analysis wasn't performed in this matter. That's essentially what the court did. So let me then move on to the issue of credibility, and this is related to the final issue that I'll be raising in oral arguments that has to do with the court's disallowance of the mileage. So what the opposing counsel has suggested is that credibility determinations are made by the trial court. This court is in no way in a posture to review them. Now, that is typically the case, but that's typically when there are trials and there are live witnesses. But here, we're in a different situation, that the record before the district court is identical to the record before the trial court. So there is absolutely no finding of fact of a live testimony, their demeanor, and all the other things that go into that, that this court owes any deference to whatsoever. And in fact, I remember a former case of mine in which a district court had made a finding on a criminal matter that my client had been driving okay, and there was a video, and the video was placed in front of this court, and this court said, no, we can disagree with the trial court because we can see the video in the exact same way. So there are instances where that rule is not ironclad or absolute, and this is one instance of it where this court has the identical record the district court did, so it doesn't have...
Are you suggesting, counsel, that we should review it, the credibility determination made by the district court de novo?
I wouldn't say it exactly that way, but in essence, yes. And what I mean by that is there's no credibility that was determined here in the way that credibility is determined.
Well, I think case law would point us in the other direction, that it is a credibility determination by the district court in terms of which evidence that's presented is more credible. Even if you don't have live testimony, that's still a credibility determination as to which expert's written submissions are more credible than the other.
So
as long as that's supported by the record, even if we would have come to a different conclusion, we still give deference to the district court's credibility determinations, assuming it is supported by the record.
Except that the jurisprudence is not as homogenous on that. There are instances.
Can you cite any case to support that position?
Commissioner, State of Minnesota versus Michelle McDonald Shimoda. It was a case I argued in front of this court, and I made that exact argument that you can't look at the video, that no matter how badly the district court looked at it.
The video is different, though, than written submissions.
It is, because the video can be interpreted two different ways, and appellate jurisdiction ought to preclude this court from overturning the determination of what the video showed. In a case where there's no video, when it's simply written submissions, There is nothing to defer to. There is no function the district court can perform that can't be performed identically by this court. It's essentially a coincidence of credibility and review of the findings de novo.
So when I read the district court's decision, I saw it being as more than just a credibility assessment, but, you know, you can give me your take on this. I mean, the district court seemed to focus on the fact that your client didn't provide any documentation about the actual mileage, about expenses for the vehicle, and it was that, you know, maybe it was that lack of documentation that led to an credibility assessment, but given that it was your client's burden of proof, why shouldn't that be an equal concern for us here?
It should be of equal concern. There's no question about that, and that's the district court's weighing of the evidence in this matter. So there's a difference between determining credibility and then giving a weight to this court.
You would agree that we should give deference to that weighing of the evidence that the sections of the district court opinion that I just read then?
No special deference. In other words, it's not the kind of deference that one would ordinarily give to credibility determinations. The weight of that evidence, when it's the identical record, is essentially the same act of jurisprudential deliberation that this court performed. In other words, the doctrine of deference to the court, it belongs to two categories of things. One is that there are live things that this can't be reproduced in front of this court. The second is in the nature of appellate versus original jurisdiction. Original jurisdiction gets a presumption of correctness, and this court is limited to simply the various standards of review that are part of the jurisprudence of appellate litigation.
Counsel, can I ask you two questions on a different matter?
Absolutely.
That's before us, but just because I want to hear from your opposing counsel about this as well. So when we're coming to the calculation of mother's income, and by not including, I believe you argued, the earned income and child credit tax credits in the income, you know, and you, I think her argument is your argument is those are periodic payments, correct?
Correct. And their argument is that they're not really payments. They're just simply deductions from the amount of taxes owed.
So once again, I want to understand what was argued to the district court a little more. So was there any distinction made at the district court in those arguments between what's the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit? Because I understand those are two different tax credits, right? I'm just trying to understand what was before the district court.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I would have to defer to counsel on that. I wasn't there. So I can't answer. It's a legitimate question, something I should have been able to answer for the court, but I'm not able to.
To your knowledge, is there any discussion about whether or not these tax credits would qualify for, you know, public assistance benefits or other forms of public assistance based on need, which would be another category?
I don't know the answer, okay. Unfortunately, to that question.
Thank you.
Okay, so the argument is that other than the doctrine of that provides this court with appellate jurisdiction, that there isn't deference except as that provided by law by the standards of review, unless there's credibility, and that doesn't apply to where the record is identical here. The court can weigh it as the court finds. Now,
I still take issue with that because we're an error-correcting court. We let the district court make the decision, and then we review to see whether there's support in the record for that decision.
Sure.
Unless it's an issue of law that we review de novo, such as a statute or a rule or something along those lines. This is still a dispute between two parties and their factual issues that are involved there.
Correct.
So I'm having a hard time.
Sure. When the court refers to the function of this court as an error correcting court, that's true, but that's not. It's that doesn't exhaust the function of this court. I have made the argument to this court that you may not, as an exercise of appellate jurisdiction, disturb the findings of a video that were favorable to my client. On review, just simply because you have the video, and I lost on that argument. So I think this court is judicially stopped from arguing a contrary position on this matter.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but go ahead.
Finally, just let me. So the last important issue that really wasn't part of the briefs that I want to get before this court is that. So with With the question I was just asked about, you know, not providing logs and so forth, okay, let's assume the court had a basis to say, I'm not going to allow all this. It sounds to me like you're trying to avoid income by cooking up a bunch of bogus miles and then paying yourself for stuff you didn't do simply to avoid paying an obligation. Even if that's true, the court doesn't then get to say, well, here is an LLC that has absolutely no mileage whatsoever. In other words, there would have to be some rational apportionment of how to disallow the mileage, because it's not plausible that there was zero mileage for a corporation or an LLC. See, my time's up. If there's a question, I'll answer. Otherwise,
of course.
But isn't the problem with that, and I understand what you're saying, that it was your client's burden to give the court that evidence?
In the very narrow way to answer the question, yes, my client had the burden once it's challenged.
So how do we get past that?
I think you by reviewing whether or not, I mean, first of all, he did meet the burden in some way without showing anything specific by showing that this is a company and this is a CPA that said that there is typically mileage associated with some company at some point, even if not as much as he claimed. Thank you.
Thank you. You could identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Nixon, and I'm here representing the respondent, Tamara Creasel. In this case, the court did not abuse its discretion in calculating child support. Specifically, the facts and the law support the district court's determination of both parties' incomes in ordering medical support and in ordering the child support begin July 1 of 2017. I'll start first with the appellant's argument as to his gross income. Looking first at the argument that the appellant is not self-employed because he's not the sole owner of the business, this was not raised in the lower court. And so the Thiele case says that this court cannot consider that here, or the appellant cannot make that argument here on appeal. Yes, there were written submissions that were made. And so he had the ability to make a legal argument exactly like this. He made a number of arguments through those written submissions, and he could have argued at that time that he was not self-employed and that somehow that statute should not apply, but he didn't. And in reviewing the record, if the court were to consider this argument, the record does support that he's self-employed. The appellant in his deposition called it a partnership LLC. The tax returns indicate that it is a partnership, and the individual tax returns indicate income from self-employment. And just looking specifically at the statute, 518A.30, the statute says that self-employment income includes joint ownership of a partnership. Here, Rossman Construction is a partnership by the appellant's own admission in his deposition, and it is jointly owned with his brother. So therefore, 518A.30 would apply.
What about the fact that it's entitled an LLC, which is a very different entity than a partnership?
Well, so he called it in his deposition a partnership LLC. There's two different ways that an LLC could be taxed on the federal level. That would be either as a partnership or a corporation. It appears here by the appellant's statement in his deposition that they've chosen to be taxed as a partnership. And so I'd argue that it is a partnership. The tax returns also indicate that they're taking benefits exactly at the same rate. You know, they're receiving the same amount of mileage, they're dividing, it didn't look like they were dividing income in any way unequally. So it looks to me by their tax returns, I'm not a CPA, but it looks to me by their tax returns that it was a partnership. Next, the appellant argues in his brief that the court did not correctly apply the statute and in fact was increasing the company's profit and in that way double assessed income to the appellant. The court correctly applied the statute here. In reviewing the statute and what the court did here, the court found gross receipts minus costs of goods sold, as is required by the statute, reduced by the amount of expenses that were claimed in the business tax returns, and then went back and analyzed those expenses that were challenged by the respondent. And as you noted, the court does note a number of times that the burden is on the party who is seeking to have that deduction made. The burden is on them to provide the information that the court needs to make those determinations that the expense is ordinary and necessary. And here it's clear from the court's order that the court did carefully consider the arguments, carefully considered arguments, both parties, carefully consider the evidence that was presented to them, and carefully consider the law here. And it appears in this double assessing argument that the appellant makes that he's arguing that all of the deductions on his tax returns should be allowed. But that's just not how the statute reads. The statute allows some expenses to be excluded, and so not allowed to be deducted, even if they're allowed by the IRS. And so moving to the challenge expenses specifically, I do want to address the mileage reimbursements and the auto expenses. So the appellant argues here that he provided enough information to the court to make that determination. But based on the information that was given, it looks as though the court really just considered what they had. And what the court does, it created a 14-page order. 6 pages of that order are very well-detailed conclusions of law explaining exactly what they considered. And in that, the court made a credibility determination. The court implied that the deposition testimony was conflicting, stating the appellant stated that he subcontracted out most of the work, that the appellant does mostly office work, it sounded like, but somehow that has him driving all over the state. The court noted that there was no documentation provided as to the actual miles driven or even an approximation of those miles driven. And the court noted that the reimbursements that were given appear to be an estimate. The same amount was given to both owners, and this is despite the fact that in his deposition, the appellant stated that him and his partner drive different directions if they are driving both to job sites during the day. And the appellant's argument here that this is actually not a credibility determination, I think that based on what the court had, it had to make a credibility determination. It was up to the court to determine whether what they had was credible enough to show that that the appellant had met his burden. And if it's not a credibility determination, then what the appellant is asking is that you weigh the evidence differently. And that is, according to the Vangsness case, that is not the job of this court. Appellant suggests here today that the court erred by not picking some number to assess to an LLC, because an LLC likely would have mileage. While that's true, if the court were to have just picked a number without any evidence, I'd argue that could very well be an error, because it wouldn't have been based on anything. The record wouldn't have supported that finding.
Well, so, speaking of errors, what about the auto expenses? Because it seems like the district court looked at his individual tax returns versus the business's tax returns for that.
Yeah, so they looked at so there was auto expenses that were deducted on his personal tax returns that he claimed were actually spent for the business. So he deducted on both his business tax returns, he deducted mileage, and then on his personal tax returns, he deducted additional mileage and then also auto expenses. So the court did look at that and considered that, again, there was no evidence provided to show that he actually spent spent his own personal money on those expenses, so auto expenses. And then also said that it appeared that the appellant was actually charging a lot of those auto expenses on his business on his business credit cards. The court had significant documents to review, and one of those was his personal credit cards and his business credit cards. And it looked like to the court that the majority of those were on his business credit cards. So it didn't look like it was supported by what he was arguing.
Counsel, could we move to the area, because I was just a little confused, and you probably know the record, and I'm sure you know the record better than I do, about whether these tax credits are periodic payments to your clients. One of the things in your brief you talk about is, well, this can't be periodic payments because tax credits aren't received by parties. But, you know, my understanding of at least the earned income tax credits is that in the Minnesota working family tax credits, those are refundable tax credits if they exceed the taxpayer's liability. So I'm struggling with both what was argued about this to the district court, because the district court doesn't address this in the order, as you know. Mm-hmm. It just says this is your income. So I suppose implicitly is saying these aren't income. But I would like to understand that, as well as, you know, your position on if would you agree that those are refundable, so the analysis should be different? And if so, what should that analysis be?
Sure. So you're correct. The court didn't address that in its order, and I made the same assumption that you did, that the court just considered it not to be income. The first submission that was submitted, the appellant just submitted a calculation of child support and included those tax credits in the respondent's income. So that's really the only way, the only means of arguing it. I did make arguments in responsive memorandums that those are not very similar to what was in the brief. So those aren't actually payments that are made to the respondent. They are they're just credits against her taxes. And another kind of issue you mentioned that, you know, that perhaps they are refundable. The earned income tax credit as a the earned income tax credit is really based on need. So I'd argue it could be seen as similar to a public benefit.
But was that argument made to the district court?
That argument was not made to the district court, no.
And is there any distinction in the arguments to the district court or that you want to make here between the earned income tax credit, which I understand is refundable, and the child tax credit?
Any difference between those two?
Yeah.
Is that your question?
I mean, that which should drive a different analysis.
I don't believe that it would drive a different analysis because I think that regardless, those credits are not actually payments received to the respondent. It's not income that she has available to her. It's not they're just simply a line item on her tax return that reduces the amount of taxes that she pays. I'd like to, if I could, and I'm happy to answer any other questions, but I'd like to touch on the arrears issue, the past support issue. So the court in its order stated that child support would begin July 1, 2017, which it was entirely within its discretion to make that determination. The case was originally commenced under 256.87, which would give the court authority to order child support for up to 2 years before the commencement of the action. The case could be also based on the recognition of parentage statute, so 257.75. The appellant specifically stated in his answer that he wanted custody and parenting time and child support to be established based on that recognition of parentage statute. That statute also gives the court the authority to order child support up to 2 years before the commencement of the action. So the court had statutory authority to make that here. The issue, though, comes in the court actually calling that past support arrears. The Hackinson case cited in my brief does state that the court can't establish an order beginning child support prior to the date of that order and then call that past support arrears. However, the Hackinson case also found that because there was a permissible basis to begin child support on the date that it did, the only thing that was really an error was calling it arrears, and that was the only thing that was impermissible. And so if the court finds on the basis of this case, the Hackinson case, that the court did err here, it's entirely within case law to order that that it's remanded with instructions to order the same commencement date, just not with the term arrears.
Counsel, can I come back to my questions about the earned income and dependent tax credits?
Sure.
So my review of the record, what I saw was that $8,280 was claimed that your client received in those tax credits in 2017. Is that fair to say?
What was the number again?
$8,280.
That sounds very high.
Okay.
And I don't have it in front of me.
Let me ask you, I go back and look at this, but
sure.
Ask you a different question. So is there anything in the record that establishes how much is due to the earned income tax credit as opposed to a dependent tax credit?
Her tax returns are in the record, and so that should be split up in her tax returns, yes. And I note, too, that while the appellant, you know, makes this argument, and I don't believe that those should be treated any differently because they're not payments, there's no relevant citations to any case law actually supporting that argument. There's two cases that the appellant cites in his brief, but those are referring to interest and dividend payments. And again, those are actually paid to a person, whereas those tax credits are not paid to a person.
You found any cases?
I have not. I diligently searched.
It just seems to me this is an issue that should have come up before.
Yes. I wish I could have, but I did not find anything.
Okay. So at most, really, you're arguing by analogy on that in terms of with respect to other cases as to why that's not considered income. It's not like she's getting a check.
Right, she's not. She's just getting a benefit on her tax return. And like I said, the interest and dividend payments that are referred to in the cases that appellant cites, those are actually payments that are received. And if you're looking at 518A.29, which defines gross income for purposes of child support, the Haefeli case discusses this. It actually refers to payments made to a party. Those are not payments made to a party, so it wouldn't fit in the statute.
But if it's a refundable tax credit, then there's a possibility, and maybe that's your argument, is a possibility isn't enough to be a periodic payment, but there's certainly a possibility she does get a check, right?
I mean, if there's a possibility that she gets a check, it doesn't mean that she actually is getting a periodic payment. Yeah, I mean, that she isn't, there was no evidence submitted that shows that she actually was getting a check, and the possibility doesn't create a periodic payment. I just want to touch on the checks written to cash, just briefly. The appellant argues that the checks written to cash, he seems to argue that they were so minimal that he didn't need to prove them to be ordinary and necessary, but that belies the plain language of the statute, which says that he has the burden to prove that these are ordinary and necessary. And the declaration that his expert submitted, we both referred to it as the Broadcorp Declaration, actually made a determination that was inconsistent with the law, stated that the best evidence of his income is the personal tax returns, but that is completely contrary to the law. And the court properly found that, properly weighed the evidence, and this court, again, would not weigh the evidence differently simply because they may weigh expert opinions differently. It looks like my time is up. I would ask that the court would affirm the lower court decision in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
No rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. The case is submitted. We appreciate your arguments and briefing. We'll have our decision within the 90 days mandated by statute.